and was recorded at Calistoga, California on July the 10th, 1975. The speaker, Gene Duffy of Calistoga. His subject, the dummies around the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for entertainment or commercial purposes. And please do not break the anonymity of the speaker or any AA member at any public level.
Now, today, I'm going to talk a little bit about things that might possibly be keeping some of you people from obtaining the sobriety that 750,000 others have found. Now, it's quite possible that in your quest for sobriety, and I only assume you have been sincere in the past, that you have gotten some bad advice, listened to some misconceptions, listened to some dumb jokes, and you might have come into contact with what I refer to as AA dummies. There are a lot of AA dummies around. Now, AA dummies are generally people who have taken the time to read the book Alcoholics Anonymous and have sort of opinionated the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to fit their own character. And because of this, they pass on their opinions, which in most cases are wrong, to those who are seeking recovery. And those who are seeking recovery listen to these opinions and become confused, become bewildered, and somehow they fail the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now let's first get it fully established in our minds exactly what AA is and exactly what AA has attempted to do. Now, 40 years ago, this program was founded. It was founded by people just like you and I. It wasn't founded by doctors. It wasn't founded by priests, educators, or scholars. It was founded by men and women who were seeking desperately to establish a new way of life based on the foundation of sobriety. How to live without taking a drink. Now, because of AA dummies, things have happened. Most of you know that many people have just come back from Denver this past weekend there. We experienced the 6th International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous, a convention which is held internationally every 5 years. This was the 6th because the first 10 years they had no convention. The first convention was held in the founding place of AA, close by, in Cleveland, Ohio. 5 years later it was held in St. Louis, Missouri. 15 years later it was held at Long Beach, California. Then it went to Toronto, Canada. And then it went to Miami Beach, Florida. And this year it was held in Denver, Colorado. 10 years ago, in Toronto, Canada, I was privileged to hear our late co-founder, Bill Wilson, make this statement, which authenticates the fact that there must be dummies around AA. In those days, we only had hands raised in the amount of 350,000 recovered alcoholics. 10 years later, today, there's 750,000. But Bill, in his talk to us at the Saturday night meeting in Toronto, made this statement. I can almost quote it word by word because it's been a part of my sobriety. He said this: "We are quick to take credit for 350,000 men and women who have seemingly recovered." As soon as he made that statement, our chests began to swell with pride and ego. And then, as Bill could do very easily, he kicked us right in the ass. So he said in the next sentence, "But what about the 650,000 who have come and not returned? Where did we fail them?" He didn't say where did they fail, or why didn't they make it, or what did they do wrong. He said, where did we fail then? Placing your responsibility right where it belongs, on the recovered alcoholic, who somehow did not get the message of sobriety across to these people. I don't know really where we have failed. I know in many areas where we have been weak, where we have been opinionated, where we have failed to explain thoroughly, and where we have misguided. And that's what I'm going to try to tell you about today, some of those areas. But to get back to exactly what AA is, we need not go any further than the very first paragraph that was ever written in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. The very first words that were ever written. Some of you may not be familiar with the fact that the book Alcoholics Anonymous was written in two editions. There are two editions to the book Alcoholics Anonymous. There is the original edition, as I have in front of me right now, the book that was written 38 years ago. After AA was 25 years old, it was decided to add some further accounts of experiences of alcoholics, causing the writing of the second edition. The foreword, the very first words written 38 years ago tell us exactly what AA is and what AA is not. I would like your permission to read that first paragraph. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered, the main purpose of our program. For them, we hope that this program will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. We think that the account of our experiences will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. For many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. And besides, we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. That's simply all in this book. The account of our experiences will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. Now let's talk about some of the things you might hear a dummy say at an AA meeting that would confuse you, or that you might have even found yourself saying. I guess one of the first signs of an AA dummy is one of them intellectuals who usually nosy around the room after a meeting telling everybody, "I'm sick and tired of hearing them goddamn drunkalogs. It's a bunch of shit, all of them drunkalogs." Now what the hell is a drunkalog? A drunkalog is an account of one member's experience. Precisely what this book tells us to do. Give the account of your experience. What you were, what happened, and what you are like now. That's a drunkalog. And that's exactly what this book tells you to do. But yet some AA dummies run around saying, "I don't want to do what the book says. I don't want to hear an account of your experiences. I want to hear your opinions on religion. I want to hear your opinions on this guy. Or I want to hear how you handle sex in AA. And there's nothing in this book that relates to any of those things. We are not in here to give opinions. We are in here to share experiences, strength, and hope. So beware. Beware the dummy who says that that's nothing but a meeting where they give a whole bunch of drunk alarms. Let's go over here to the intellectual group. I'll tell you how you can always determine what an intellectual group is. That's a group that never has an anniversary because none of them ever get a year's sobriety. That's how you can tell an intellectual group. They're usually drunk every other meeting or every 3 months. That's an intellectual group. They usually paraphrase or describe their group as beyond AA. That sounds nice. I used to know an old song that I used to hear when I was drunk. Beyond the sunset, you know. And that's what that beyond AA or sobriety and beyond, you know. What the hell is beyond AA, you know? What the hell is beyond AA? I don't know. It's the most important thing in my life because it has given me the most important thing in my life. It has given me life. I don't have to go beyond life because I'm not entitled to it. I'm not qualified to. But yet these dummies get mixed up in that. Then another way you can always spot an AA dummy. So come on with this shit. There are no musts in AA. Oh, yeah. A lot of the bleeding deacons even still say that despite the fact that they know they're lying. And that's exactly what they are. And I challenge any of you who sit in this room if you are making that statement. And I flatly declare in full view of everybody else that you are a liar. If you have told anybody that there are no musts in this program. But I need not take any more than 1 minute to walk back into my office and get the little red book of AA out and turn to the next to the last page where it will list 27 times in this book where the word must is used. And yet, people who supposedly have read this program of recovery, these accounts of our experiences, defy that. They say, no, there are no musts in there. Well, I can thumb right through it and underline a circle in big red pencil where it says must. So a lot of people tend to believe as long as there's no must, I can sort of do what I want. And then they get drunk. And then they get drunk. Then there's another kind of an AA dummy. He's usually a guy that's lazy. He's the lazy type AA dummy. You generally come to he or she with a problem or with a question. And because he or she is too goddamn lazy to help you out or take a few moments out of their busy life to share with you what has been given to them so freely, they brush you off with this remark. Don't complicate the program. Don't be asking all that crap. Work it the best way it suits you. Has anybody in here ever been told that? To work this program the best way it suits you? Sure, I was told that when I stayed drunk for 6 years. Because the best way it suited me was drinking before meetings, drinking after meetings, and only coming to AA when I was in shit. That's the way it suited me. And that was the wrong way. The wrong way. And it wasn't until I was to learn the right way that I achieved any sobriety. And then another AA dummy is the guy that travels all over saying, well, it was different where I got it. You've heard that crap, you know. I really got AA in Chicago. Boy, that Bowery AA is tough. Grace Cathedral has a beautiful group. It's different, you know. Here's the book right here. Chapter 5, right up here. Chapter 5 says how it works. It doesn't say how it works in the Grace Cathedral. or how it works in Chicago, how it works in West Los Angeles, or how it works in San Diego. How it works. Another radio dummy will tell you that, but then it's in a group where there's your kind of people. Your kind of people. Thank God I didn't fall for that one. Because my kind of people were still drinking. That's the last group I wanted to be in with. But they say, if you're homosexual, hang out with the homosexual group. If you're a truck driver, go to the truck driver's group. If you're a doctor, oh, they got a separate place for the doctors. I even seen the grapevine. Doctors in AA have their own little convention, ain't that great? Next, we're going to have black people in AA, Indians in AA, guys with one leg group. Remember in that book, does it say how it works for Indians? How it works for guys with one leg? And why doctors should be different? No. How it works for you? The very first sentence in the fifth chapter of this book tells it all. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. It does not say, rarely have we seen a homosexual fail who has not followed a homosexual path. Don't say that. It doesn't say, rarely has doctors failed unless they went to another group that wasn't doctors. It doesn't say that. We, as the very first sentence says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women. And that's the only time we have been segregated. Men and women. The only point of difference in the physical makeup of the program Alcoholics Anonymous, who have seemingly recovered ED. Recovered ED. Not recovering. Who have seemingly recovered. But not from alcoholism. We don't say that. We don't say we have seemingly recovered from alcoholism. We have seemingly recovered from a helpless state of mind and body. And of course that has to be true. If it wasn't true, you wouldn't even be here today. But your people will confuse you. They'll say, well, yes. Alcoholic, you've got a disease. Then you'll see one of them dummies get up and says, yes, I'm an alcoholic, but I can accept it because it's a disease. Disease similar to polio, cancer, or diabetes. I'd like to kick a guy in the ass when he says that. The American Medical Association, of course, is responsible for that faux-pas. They're the ones that said it's a disease, and rightfully so, because that's the only group of people who are qualified to designate what is a disease and what is not. Unfortunately, they left it hanging. They didn't tell us what kind of a disease it was. They didn't tell us if it was a mental illness, a physical illness, a social illness, moral illness, or what. But they're working on it. They're working on it. But, you know, if it is a disease, it is not similar to cancer and polio and diabetes. Because people with cancer and polio don't go around batting their wives all around the house. People with diabetes don't wind up in diabetes tanks on Saturday night. People with cancer don't go running around screaming, give me a drink before I die! They don't beat up a little kid. They don't fill up the divorce courts and the mental institutions. But I think it's a big cop-out. I think when you get up and try to relate your illness as a disease similar to cancer or polio, you're only setting yourself up for another drink. I really and honestly believe that. I guess one of the most insane statements that I've ever heard an AA dummy make is one that encompasses a whole meeting. that we do here, and we'll do at a future date. Not that AA dummy who defines insanity by saying I would have to be insane to drink again because I know what's going to happen to me. Let there be no doubt in your mind that there walks no mortal human being on the face of this earth that has the power to predict the outcome of any future event, especially the alcoholic who is going to inject into his or her system the number one drug known to man, number one mood-altering agent known to man. And if you're about to alter your mood, the price for that alteration is forfeiture of choice as to what is going to happen to you. So you do not know, as so many AA dummies have come up with, I'd have to be insane to drink. Or keep drinking and you'll wind up in jail. That's a good way to keep a guy drunk. I never really minded jail so much, especially when I was on Skid Row and if it was winter time, because I loved being in a warm Cook County jail in Chicago when it was 8 or 9 below zero. I had even gone out of my way to be noticed by the paddy wagon. Take me in. That might sound a little insane, and it probably is. But you do a lot of insane things when you're drunk. But you don't forget the outcome of the drunk. I can remember one time, and I was just thinking of this guy in Denver because the guy told me he's on AA, this cop. Not that I thought he had a drinking problem in those days, but there was a guy that was on West Madison Street, which is Chicago's Skid Row, in the patrol wagon, Officer Sabuka, his name was, a big Polish guy. Tougher than goddamn nails, too. Okay. Big, burly guy. But he sort of liked the alcoholic. So now I can see why, you know, if he's on AA now. He was sort of a good guy, you know. He didn't rough you up too much, and it was cold, you know, he saw to it that you got in. And even after you got busted and got thrown in the drunk tank, if I can recall, he always had enough compassion where he'd come up to the third tier or wherever the hell you were, and he'd look into the drunk tanks to make sure there was nobody in there having a convulsion or a seizure, and if there was, he'd see that they get transferred to the hospital. So he was a very dedicated, compassionate law enforcement officer. And I could remember one time, it was right after a rain, and it wasn't cold, so I didn't really want to go in. Let me tell you how they do it in Chicago. I don't know how many holding cells there are in the city of Chicago, so I'm just going to use some rough figures. But they'll be pretty close. The state of Illinois gives Cook County $5 a day for every cell that's occupied during the 24-hour period. In other words, the city of Chicago gets that money. If there's 200 men in jail during the day, then the state has to give them $1,000. So you can readily see that smart business would mean to fill up the cell every day. It'd be ideal to call in at 5 minutes to midnight and say, we've got 500 men in custody right now. That gives the state of Illinois a bill for $2,500. And then 10 minutes later, you go into the next day and they kick you all out. And so you haven't even used the cell for half an hour. If you really analyze it, it's possible to collect for 3 days in a two-day period doing that. And I'm quite sure they did it. Chicago's known for a lot of cute things that they do. Well, in order to fill up the cells at night, and there are law enforcement officers here in the office, in the building here right now, and I guess that they do similar, the same thing in San Francisco, they have what they call the sweep. And the sweep comes at about 11 o'clock at night, right down Madison Street. Generally 4 or 5 paddy wagons, not racing the sirens going or anything like that. Just walla, 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 you know, right down the street. And you in like that. And the guys walk right over and get in, or pick them up and they throw it in. And how that takes place at 11 o'clock is see, they're trying to fill up the cell. So I guess somewhere, you know, in the police department, they must phone in around 10:30 at night and say, we got 6 empty cells at the Racine Street Station. We got 4 empty cells at the Lincoln Park Station. We got 6 empty cells at Oak Park, or we got 6 empty cells at this, or whatever. And by 11 o'clock, they know how many empty cells they got. So maybe they got 180 empty cells. So the dispatcher calls up the vans, and he says, pick up 180. And that's exactly what they pick up. They don't pick up 181. They don't pick up 179. They pick up 180. So that they're booked before midnight. It's quite possible that most of them are going to get kicked out at half an hour after midnight. Well, I was sitting there, and when did that say? When did that say? But I was sitting there in the spring, right after the spring rain, and unless you're from the Middle West, you wouldn't know what that's like. It gets sultry as hell, you know, after a thunderstorm, and it's just muggier and crap, and if you're like me and you got a little class and you're trying to keep clean, you usually take your shoes and stockings off and you sit in the curb and let the cold water run across your feet, you know, and you push the cigarette butts away and other kind of crap, and you wash yourself off and get cool. And it's nice to have a bottle of wine for respite too while you're sitting there because it's boring. And I was sitting there one spring evening and Sabuka come by. And they got the wagon packed. They must have been up to, probably needed 180, and they were up to about 178. So I wanted to go in a way. I'm raising my hand, I'm Sabuka. And he's all filled up. He says, wait there till I come back. And an hour and a half later, he come back, and I was sitting there waiting for him. Waiting to be thrown in the goddamn drink tank. Now, so that's why, you know, jail was not that big a deal. So when people used to say to me, keep it up, boy, you're going to wind up in the bucket. You know, he was making a prediction. In other words, he was saying, well, because you're drinking, the result of your drinking is going to put you in jail tonight. Well, there was many nights that that didn't happen. There were some nights when I thought I was going to go to jail, and I wound up strapped down in the Chicago State Hospital and combined.
Please turn to slide 2 of this cassette to continue with the program.
Many nights that that didn't happen. There were some nights when I thought I was going to go to jail, and I wound up strapped down in the Chicago State Hospital and convulsed with VT. There was another time I thought all I was going to do was get drunk and get thrown in jail or a hospital, and I got the living hell beat out of me in a little alley in an old abandoned car about an inch from losing my life by about 4 kids from some smart-ass high school in Cicero. Just for kicks, you know, just for kicks. Going through the little alleys, you know, and pulling me drunk out of the abandoned automobiles and the empty cartons that we called our homes. And just for the Arabs beating the hell out of you. So I listen to a AA dummy who comes around with this, I can predict what's going to happen to you as a result of your continuing to drink. AA dummies, again, are people who, in my opinion, don't walk like they talk. One of the easiest things in the world to do is open your mouth. That's about the easiest thing I know to do. Don't take a whole lot of energy. It's open. Doesn't even require much effort to say something out of that mouth. And it doesn't take a hell of a lot of intelligence to say something to a dummy and let him think it's intelligent. Because at that stage when you and I are sick, we are willing to listen to anything. Evidence of that fact is how many people you and I ask for serious advice when we're drunk. I guess the greatest character defect and the greatest mystery in the field of alcoholism is why, in our drunkenness, do we stand so easily ready to accept advice and wisdom from people who aren't even qualified to give it to us? And we accept it as gospel truth and usually do it without any question. Think. You ever walk into someone at 7 o'clock in the morning and say, who's going to die? Jesus, what can I do to What's the best thing in the world for that? Some stupid bartender says, I got this and that. You get eggs and workers and sour syrup and salt and pepper, wraps napkins around it, kicks it with his feet, and spits in it and says, here, this. And you believe him. Oh, what could you do? Here, take your advice. Take your advice. But yet when we get sober, when we get in a state of reality as you are now, and some guy who has seemingly recovered walks up to you and says, let's cure the air illness. What I know is, keep going to meetings. I can't go to all of goddamn meetings. I can't go Monday night. Howard Cassell's on Wednesday night. I gotta go here Thursday night. Here. But I have a meeting at 10 after 7 on Saturday morning. That's the only time I'm free. We don't want to take that advice. And believe me, and I say this in all sincerity, regardless of how professional you are or how active in any part of this field you are, whether you are a counselor or a lecturer or what, you are entitled to your opinions and I'm entitled to mine. I believe that the only answer, as of this day, to the problem of alcoholism lies in the truth and the wisdom that can be passed on from a recovered alcoholic to a recovering alcoholic if he or she is willing to listen. And if he or she is willing to listen, then the steps, the wheel has to be put into motion. It's bring about the three, in my opinion, key components of a quest for sobriety. Acceptance, honesty, and the third I'll tell you about later. When we define, or I defined, the word alcoholic here today, if you are sincere and have accepted that definition, the wheels are now in motion. So you see, since you have to know what you are, you've got to know what the thing is before you can diagnose it or enter into any prognosis. You've got to know what it is. I assume now that you have accepted that definition. Those of you who said, my name is Joe and I'm an alcoholic. This program makes only one demand, which is a word a lot stronger than must. This program makes an absolute demand. And for those of you who are running around saying there are no musts, I recall to you in the fifth chapter the word demand. Where it says, this is a program that demands rigorous honesty. And that honesty is only concerned with your acceptance to your diagnosis as an alcoholic. I honestly accept the fact that I have lost the ability to control my drinking. Now, if you can do that, you're well on your way. And then comes the third cog of the wheel, or the third point of the key. Action. You have to do something about it. You cannot just sit and accept in honesty what's wrong with you and expect it to get well if you don't do anything about it. I accept the fact that I have a cold. I'm honest enough to know that I've got a cold. But it ain't gonna get any goddamn better until I do something about it. And then that's where the foreword to this book comes in. We, who have seemingly recovered, can show you precisely how we have recovered. And that's all we can do. We can show you. And then it's entirely up to you. You can fight it. You can reject it. You can sit around for years and pick it apart. You can lie about it. You can offer your opinions about it. You can change the words in this book to suit you. But we can guarantee you, which we do, in the third chapter of this book, that if you want to play those so-called games, that this is exactly what's going to happen to you. And we can only say that because it was you who said you were alcoholic, not me. Not your boss, not your wife or your friends. And I think it would be rather idiotic if any of you at the outset of this meeting had identified yourself as an alcoholic just for the hell of it. That's a hell of an attitude to have about something that can take your very life away from you any minute just like that. And that includes any of you sitting in this room who has not been sober or without a drink for 21 days. Well, you see, it is that serious. It's highly possible and probable that any of you within that 21-day span can convulse at this very minute, can enter into a seizure state at this very minute, or fly off into Never-Never Land with the delirium tremors this very minute, and die. Because that has happened in this room. In this very room. And there are people sitting in here right now who were here when these things happened. So it's no time to have a lighthearted attitude about what in the hell is wrong with us. Now, I knew what was wrong at first, but I wasn't honest enough to admit to myself that I had lost that ability. I started picking holes in it, just like you. Yes, I'm an alcoholic, but I'm a 24-year-old alcoholic. That's what I said 26 years ago. I am different from you because you're a 50-year-old alcoholic. Let's find it. How it works for 50-year-old alcoholics. How it works for 24-year-old alcoholics. Ain't in there like that. How it works, it says. Didn't say for young guys, old guys, fat guys, skinny guys, redheads, or brunettes. So I was not different. But because I insanely thought I was different and listened to those dummies who made me different or think I was different, I continued to fail this program. I poked the holes. That's the oldest cliche of all for losers. Hell, I'm not as bad as him. I haven't done that. Everybody on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous started out clean. Remember that. When you hear these speakers get up before you giving their account of their experiences, let there be no doubt in your mind, they didn't start out in prison. You don't start out on Skid Row. You don't get born in a nut house. You don't get born in prison or jail. All of these things are End result of what? End result of exactly what it says in this book. where it says the persistence in the illusion that you and I can regain the ability to control our drinking will lead us either to insanity or death. Now, perhaps you just shot a couple of holes as I said that. You might have said, what the hell are them assholes? No. There's degrees written after that. They ain't got an author. Who the hell ever heard of the Works Publishing Company? Whatever books have they written? No movie credit. Paul Newman and know about alcoholism. No. You see, you only make movies out of stories. This is not a story. This is a text. A text. And because everybody in this room is an intellectual like some of you, I should explain what a text is. A text is defined in the dictionary as a continuous source of learning. That's what a text is. And when you refer to learning as a continuing process, that means you go back to the text. You don't take it like you took the Godfather 1 and throw it up on the shelf after you finished it. Keep it out and you refer to the text. I can't guarantee you nothing. No member of AA can actually guarantee you anything. But I can guarantee myself one thing. I can guarantee that I will have the best shot at sobriety if I continue to refer to the text. Because I have found out in 26 years that the answers to any problem I ever had relating to alcoholism, the answer was in this book, if I sought it. And if I sought it and couldn't find it, I asked somebody else to help me find it. I didn't put my ego in front of me and hide behind it and let somebody think, well, he's a dumb son of a bitch, it's written right there, he couldn't find it. I was sincere in my quest for sobriety. I had finally got to that point that you will get to, where that pain will hurt so bad that you cast away that pride and that foolishness and that arrogance, and you say, I need help. And I only pray that you reach that point before you die. Because another thing that AA dummies tend to lead us to believe, as this so-called downhill pursuit toward degradation, that it comes step by step, that you start down slowly. Little jail time, little hospital time, little loss of job, loss of family, loss of wife, loss of respect, boom, 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 death. Then we try to, tell you that. You can usually hear them telling you this way. They usually tell it to the wife of an alcoholic, or the husband of an alcoholic wife. Jesus, I just got a chill when I thought of it, just now. Rather than some son of a bitch is saying that someplace today. You ever hear some jackass say, leave him alone, he ain't hit his bottom yet. I know you've heard that. Let him hit his bottom, then he'll bounce back. A lot of people hit their bottoms and they don't bounce, they splatter. They splatter. Sitting here in AA dummy say, well, the doors are always open, keep coming back. Sure, the doors are always open. But you can get there. If you can get there. I heard a woman in Denver make some good statements that I never thought of, and it's true. She said, I've never been on Skid Row, and I got sitting here saying, thinking in my head, oh shit, I got to listen to one of these social broads again. And he says, because I was too drunk to get down there. Yes. So I started listening. Not to the dummies anymore. To the recovered ED. ED. Who had recovered from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And then I started doing good action, doing what they told me to do. Oh, not working it my way anymore. Oh, no, no, no. I mean, I stopped working it my way and let them change my attitude. And then I began to grasp a little bit of the sobriety. And they explained all of the things that I had been doing wrong. Didn't explain them to me as a point of trying to put me down. They explained them to me only as a source of learning, so that perhaps I wouldn't pass on any misinformation if I ever got to the point where I was to work with an alcoholic. Oh, you hear so many of them, we could stand here all afternoon and talk about the not to do's in AA. I have to run right now for that party who asked me just before the meeting. Is it all right to have a man for a sponsor? Many years ago in AA, a woman approached the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and her husband was thrilled to death about it. He said, are you really going to try it? And she said, yes, I've got the loveliest man who's going to be the sponsor. He's such a dear fellow, and he's doing so much for me. He takes over for 2 days, and the husband was enthralled. The night of the third day, she said, honey, I've got to go over to Bob's house. We're going to work on the big book tonight. And he said, go ahead, dear. No, she went. The fourth night, she went over to Bob's house to work the big book. The fifth and the sixth and the seventh and the eighth. And then up to about 2 months of every night, she's going over to Bob's house to work on the big book. One night, she was in a little bit of a hurry. She told her husband, he said, is tonight a night you got to go work on the big book? And she said, yes. She says, I'm running a little late, honey. She says, while I'm fixing dinner, will you run my bath for me upstairs? And he said, I'd be glad to. And he went upstairs and he turned the water on, and in a couple of seconds he hollered down. So he said, honey, your bath is ready. He says, now you can go over to Bob's and work on the big book. And she went upstairs to get into the bathtub, and she hollered down and says, honey, there's only about an eighth of an inch of water in the tub. And he says, dear, I don't want you to get your big book wet.